thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 46 for the 27th of October, 2009. Theremin Dreams. I'm Dan Cohen. Time yet again for another Digital Campus podcast here from the scenic and leaf-changing campus of George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, just outside of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. I'm Dan Cohen, and I'm back with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
Found at Found History and also at Found History on Twitter. And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
At EdWired in a fake way on Twitter and edwired.org for his excellent blog on digital pedagogy and other things. Welcome back, guys. Good to talk to you again. And we are continuing for the third podcast in a row our tradition of adding some new, what we're calling irregulars, so we offend them right out of the gate. we've got two newbies on the podcast, although I think one has been on the podcast before, I believe a year ago. Actually, why don't we start with him, Brian Alexander, who is talking to us from Vermont, where it really must be scenic at this time of year in October. Hi, Brian.
Greetings.
And Brian, you are, I hope I get your title right, but you are director of Knightley or technical director of Knightley. Can you talk a little bit about your position at Knightley and what Knightley is?
Oh, you've got it almost completely wrong.
Oh, gosh. I know I was going to. I should have asked
Knightley's,
for
it. Knightley's director of research. We're a nonprofit. We work with small liberal arts campuses and small colleges across the U.S. I'm the director of research, so I keep an eye on emerging technologies and try and translate them for small campuses.
Great.
We just relaunched our website, so if you go to knightley.org, you can actually find information about us.
Great. And we should point out that's NITLE.org.
Correct. The National Institute for Technology in Liberal Education.
Great. Well, it's great to have you on the podcast. And of course, you're available in many forms online on Twitter at Brian Alexander, B-R-Y-A-N, Alexander.
Correct. Correct.
And what's your favorite? But you've got a terrific blog on, what shall we call it? On the Info Cult, your Info Cult blog. Can you talk a little bit about that and then your main Knightley blog?
Oh, Info Cult is, draws on my long-time research project of looking at how people come up with fears and anxieties about digital technologies, and that's its primary focus. At Knightley, we now have three blogs. I run the blog called Liberal Education Tomorrow, and that tries to look at emerging technologies. Got about three and a half posts a day right now.
Terrific. A great and important blog, I think, for anyone who's interested in the impact of digital media and technology on campuses, museums, and libraries. A really essential place to go. Later on, talking about something else that you're running, which is the Horizon Report, which tracks these important digital trends and what they're doing to the academy. So we'll hear about that later in the podcast. From the north to the middle, we go out to Nebraska to talk to Steve Ramsey. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I this is, of course, my second time on the podcast, and I just want to say I am so glad to be back on Car Talk with you guys. It's a distinct pleasure.
How was that muffler fix? Did that work for you?
Yeah, we need that music to indicate that it didn't go so well, I guess.
We haven't had any Car Talk yet on the podcast, but I do know that our distinguished panelist, Mills Kelly, actually was on Car Talk at one point. Isn't that right, Mills?
That is correct. In either 1998 or 1999, I can't remember. No, 1997 or 1998. Long time ago.
So jealous.
I haven't, which is why I guess I'm an irregular.
Right. Well, welcome back to the podcast, Steve. That's right. We've had both of you on before, so it's great to have you back on, and we're looking forward to having you on an irregular basis as part of our ongoing effort to have people who are smarter than us join us on the podcast. So great to have you on. And Steve, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do at Nebraska?
Yeah, I'm an associate professor of English and also a fellow at the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities, which is our I guess our Midwestern equivalent of CHNM in many ways. And I mainly, you know, my main specialty for the university is teaching digital humanities. I teach programming and software engineering to history and English majors, among other things.
Okay. And, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of terrific digital things going on at Nebraska. Good digital history component, things in electronic literature, and what are you're working on a book on mathematics right now for?
Yeah, I have two books going. One is on computers and literary study, and sort of how we, you know, my main specialty is text analysis and visualization stuff, and you know, I think a lot about what that kind of work means for literary study, literary criticism. And then I'm also co-writing a book with Patrick Eula at Duquesne University called Mathematics for Humanists that tries to explain some of the kind of more advanced math that is involved with doing computational work to an audience that's not trained in research mathematics. So.
That's great. Very exciting, interesting book. And so, Steve, you're found on Twitter at sramsay, S-R-A-M-S-A-Y.
That's
and
correct.
And your very excellent blog, which we'll also talk a little bit about later on in the podcast.
You want to talk about its new, extremely minimalistic look.
I'm looking at it right now, and the it's almost Ansel Adams-esque in its...
Yes, yes. That was exactly what I was hoping
all
you would
colors
say.
Have been purged from yes. Steve Ramsey's blog, which is at lens, L-E-N-Z dot U-N-L dot E-D-U. We'll talk about that a little bit later on today. Thank you, Steve, for putting up with the mocking. Well, let's dive in. We've got a ton of news, most of which we're going to try to make unrelated to Google, since this podcast had... suddenly become all things Google. But still, I guess some related issues relating to e-books and technologies that I guess are related to some of the things Google are doing, like Android. Well, why don't we start off with this? Barnes & Noble is releasing a new e-book reader called the Nook, which looks pretty nice. It actually uses Google's Android, I want to call it a mobile operating system. I'm not sure what it is since it's going on many different devices, but mostly found on cell phones like Tom Scheinfeld's cell phone. But also has that e-ink technology in the top three quarters for your reading. Is this something, a watershed when an actual bookstore with the size and scope of Barnes & Noble's comes out with an e-reader? I guess should we say at this point that they have come of age? And that this is something we're going to see. Tom, what did you think about this announcement and how it relates to the other Kindle stories we've been following?
I think this is actually the first real competition we've seen for the Kindle. I'm thinking, you know, I think the device has some unique features which we can talk about, but I really think the fact that it's going to be in Barnes & Noble retail stores for Christmas means that a lot of these are gonna come off the shelves. I think this is it's a little expensive, but it's the kind of thing that you might pick up for the person who has everything and likes to read. So I think this is some competition for the Kindle, and I think that's a good thing. And I think maybe that does mean these devices have come of age.
It is sort of. I mean, most of the people I've seen with Kindles really are sort of confirmed geeks, and it does seem like a device that sits in a Barnes & Noble and asks to be read there, and also has the neat functionality of being able to read any book while you're in a Barnes & Noble. Seems like a pretty great idea on, you know, since they want to have people keep coming back into their stores after all to drink Starbucks coffee and buy paper books. Mills, what did you think about this announcement and that product?
Well, I mean, I think it is nice to see some competition for the Kindle, if only because then that will drive Amazon to create a better version of the Kindle. I finally, after all this time of criticizing it without actually using it, I did get to try a Kindle while I was away on vacation last weekend. And I have to say, I really don't like it. And
why is that?
I don't like having so little text in front of me, I guess, and so maybe that means I'll never read books on an iPhone. But it transformed the book for me. It transformed the reading experience from a book to just a few pixels on a screen. Also, my eyes aren't the best, and I had a hard time reading it even with the text boosted up, and that had to do with the lighting scheme. You know, sort of the color and the lighting. It was just too gray.
Those e-ink readers are really gray, right? Brian, Steve, do you have one of these devices, or
I
are
do.
You waiting? Which one do you have?
I, I did. Well, I bought the, and I can tell you exactly what I was waiting for. I was waiting for it to be able to do PDFs, because everything I'm reading all the scholarly articles I'm reading are always PDF, and so I was waiting for that. And I have to say, I love it. But I absolutely think that you will know whether you love it or hate it within about 30 seconds. The screen is either working for you perfectly or you just can't stand it. The size of the text block is either exactly what you want. I mean, people have a strong reaction to it either way. But I wanted to say that, you know, you said you only see geeks with Kindles. And I wish I could point to the source of this data, but I've now read it a few times. I mean, as you know, Amazon is very, they're very tight-fisted about any kind of demographics. They don't want to talk about how many they've sold. They don't want to talk about who they've sold them to. But there's some evidence that one of the big markets for these readers, or they were surprised by the degree to which these were being bought up by seniors, by old people. And ever since I heard that, I've been trying to figure out
why. You mean for the text size? What do you think is it that?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm really at a loss. It's hard for me. As much as I like it, I can't say that it has the. I mean, you know, I think the screen is miraculous, but it's not a paper page. A paper page is perfect. if you have trouble reading, I can't imagine it going to this. So whatever it is, there is some other thing it is tapping into.
Well, I would love to see that story about seniors. I do know that when I show people the Kindle, people who identify or self-identify with eye problems, they love the two-click change text size. And almost every time I show it to a group of two or more people, someone asks about that first or second thing.
Well, maybe that's it. I know my about to be 70 father thinks it's the greatest thing he's ever beheld, and he's been a lifelong reader, just loves it.
Yeah, see, in my case, I think it's my eyes aren't that bad yet, and so if they were that bad, then I would want it, that I'd really want that ability to upgrade the size of the, or increase the size of the text. But I don't know. I'm not loving it. I fell into the category that you all just described. You either love it or hate it right away. I was definitely a hate it.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say, I'm an early adopter. I've got Kindle One. And I've got to say, by the way, that the obsession with thinness of ebook readers is pathological. I mean, if you have a Kindle One, no one thinks, oh, that's too thick. You know, it weighs like a pound.
Yeah.
No, but I find two populations that I see who really respond to it. And one is travelers, air travelers. And when I fly, I often see one out there. The second is book people. It's not an MP3 player. It's not aimed at the general audience. It's clearly aimed at people who love books. If you just pick one up, I don't mean this as a reason for you not liking it, man, but it's when you pick it up, it forces your hands into the position of reverence that those of us who are book freaks really naturally do. I use mine every day. I have it. I use it when I fly. I read from it at home. I'm a big fan of it. This is Kindle One. You know, this is the extra fat and heavy one. You know, and the small memory. It merely holds 200 books or something. Oh, we could talk about it forever, but that's
right. It follows that pattern in technology you see all the time. You know, it has four cores. It has an extended pipeline. You're like, do I want that?
The Nook has a color screen. Of course you want it. Yeah. The Nook has this color screen running along the bottom, which I guess is the Android piece of it. I wonder if that's actually a distraction if you are a reverent black and white book reader. Maybe you don't want that extra bit on the bottom distracting you with... Yes.
I did hear a worse criticism of that. Popular Mechanics had a piece on what they liked and what they didn't like about it. And one of the things they didn't like was they thought the second screen would chew up battery and unnecessarily.
That's interesting.
The battery life is one of the things I love about the Kindle. I just forget to charge the thing. I just have it going for days. But that color, that extra screen, that's one thing.
I think one of the things about the Nook that's going to make it a real competitor to the Kindle is The fact that it's going to be much more open than the Kindle. It's going to read all of the main file formats, PDFs, EPUB, others. It's also going to be able to play audio files. Because it's running on Android, it's going to be, and I think this is the biggest thing of all, it's going to be hackable in a way that the Kindle just isn't. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some future versions of this. I think that small little screen doesn't really quite do it, but some future versions of this with, for instance, a real web browser in there, or a real music player, or even some telephone applications, some voice over IP applications, so that this could, and it's a touch screen, so in some ways this could end up serving as the device in the way that I think people are hoping that Apple's forthcoming or supposedly forthcoming tablet will be the device, the all-in-one device. I think that something that looks like or has the feature set of this Nook, I don't know whether this is it or not, but something that has this kind of feature set it could make a play for that one device position.
It does seem that this is yet another device, unlike the Kindle, that has adopted this EPUB open standard for electronic books that really seems to be taking off, and that any device that uses that gets for free all of the books in that Google has digitized that are in the public domain and that are in the EPUB format, which I think is now a million of them. You know, you can kind of say, as the Sony Reader does, as the Nook does, that it ships with a million books. And Amazon is kind of stuck with this proprietary format that they're alone with.
Well, I don't mean to be an evangelist for the Kindle. I think it has some serious limitations, and the file format is one of the biggest, not to mention DRM and a few other things. But I think it's important to note that it's not entirely closed proprietary. It can read text files, and one of the things I've been doing is experimenting with how much free content I can get into it. So on the one hand, I create text files by taking PDFs, copying text into a text file, and just cabling it over with a simple PC to Kindle cable. The second thing I do is I go through the Amazon store, the Kindle store, looking for free books, and a lot of them are public domain. Some of them are promotional. But there's a ton of books that cost you $0 and 0 cents. And when you buy them, you get billed $0 and 0 cents. And you can get quite a lot of stuff that way.
I will say,
put that out there.
Yeah, in the same vein, so as not to appear to be a Kindle evangelist, I would say one thing that absolutely drives me up the wall is Amazon has no awareness, evinces no awareness whatsoever of any distinction between editions. I mean, none. So if you're looking at a book, say you're looking at a translation of the Iliad, and you want to read Robert Fagel's translation of the Iliad, and there's a little box down there that says, you can read this on the Kindle right now. And when you click on that, it might be a translation of the Iliad from 1860. It might be that entire vector of book identity, if you like, is completely effaced. And it seems to me totally inexcusable. It's as if to say, well, books, who cares? The Iliad is the Iliad. Who cares who translates it? Who cares what? Oh, you wanted the 1989 edition of this book? I mean, is that any different from the 1923? They just do this right across the board. And it just... It almost feels sort of elitist. I don't know why that word suggests itself, because it seems like, they don't care. The people don't care what. A book's a book for these people.
Well, I think that's an issue for scholarly publication. I'm looking here at my... I just downloaded a Dante for free, The Divine Comedy, and the translator is in the title field. So it reads Divine Comedy, comma, Caridi's translation. But that's the only way you'd know. I don't want to drag on too much about this. One more thing about the Nook that Popular Mechanics mentioned that I have to admit, as an English prof, I look for these things. It's the most embarrassing name in technology since we. I'm just waiting. Here's my Nook. Look, if you give it to somebody, look, you got some Nook. I mean, that's just not right.
It does sound vaguely obscene, I have to say.
Well, if it's eNook, then Nook. Oh, he's, no.
Yeah.
It's so wrong. Yeah.
I think our podcast is rated G on the iTunes Music Store, so I think we should probably move on here. Well, another new device that sort of caught our eye over at Digital Campus headquarters, and that I think I was a skeptic for a while, but looking at Tom's device, he's got an Android phone, which is the G1. Is that right, Tom?
Yep.
And then seeing there are now, I mean, I just saw a list this past week. There are now 50 new Android devices coming out in the next couple of months, mostly phones, but also some standalone devices like the Arcos 5 that runs Android. This is an open operating system. You can put, unlike the iPhone, you can put anything on it. At a conference up in Toronto that we'll talk about a little bit later on, I was really impressed with people who had Android phones and were kind of using them to run arbitrary software code that they wouldn't have to go through Apple to get onto their phone. And this Droid is going to be a new phone built by Motorola. Looks a lot like the iPhone, but running this Android 2.0 operating system, and it'll be out from Verizon. First big Verizon phone that runs one of these kind of modern smartphone operating systems. Tom, you've been tracking the Android world. Is this an important development that Verizon's going out with this splashy new phone?
I mean, I think it's definitely a huge development. I know lots of people who are very unhappy with their handsets, but they will not leave Verizon because Verizon just has, I think, what is undoubtedly the best coverage of any of the U.S. carriers. And I think that the Verizon announcement means that all of the major U.S. carriers except AT&T now have Verizon phones, many of them multiple different all of them have Android phones, many of them multiple different handsets. So I think Android is making a real play, and I think all of the players other than AT&T and Apple see it as a kind of real competitor, and I think it really has now taken its place as the real competitor to the iPhone. I see it going places with Verizon. Who knows what Verizon will do, and Motorola for that matter, will do to Android. Android is an open source product, and they are free to mod it. And I'm afraid of the kinds of mods that they'll make. But it's a big deal, I think.
You know, it does seem to go along with the pattern that we've been discussing here on the podcast for several years, that Mills, you've been the real champion on of getting one of these mobile devices into the classroom. Android presents a really good way to have an open operating system, non-cellular device that you could take into the classroom, let's say use for exercises. Brian, I'm sure you track this as well, let's say the use of clickers or other kinds of devices. Android seems a lot easier than, let's say, an iPod Touch to kind of get the software on it, get it used in the classroom, and I assume also the pricing will come way down because there'll be so many handset makers to put the stuff to put this operating system on.
I think this is what's finally going to open it up. I mean, I not this particular phone, but over the next year, I think the more sort of Android platforms we see, the more we're going to see people who actually know something about creating technology that I don't, creating stuff that they will use in their classrooms, and you know, then students are going to start playing around with it and modifying it in other interesting ways. And so I think we're kind of at the very beginning of an interesting trajectory on handheld devices for educational purposes.
You know, I did see this demo that Bill Turkel, we've had on the podcast before, he showed me on his Android phone just taking a picture of what's called a QR code, which are these new kinds of two-dimensional barcodes. And they look like sort of a graph piece of paper with some of the cells colored in. And he took a picture of that and actually ran a program on his phone. And you could just imagine it downloaded and ran that program. So you could imagine a classroom exercise where all the students come in with Android devices and just take a quick snapshot of one of these little codes on a syllabus or something like that, and they can get the assignment from that day. It's really a kind of on-demand sort of a device in the way that iPhone syncing to iTunes, syncing to the iTunes store to get your apps sort of thing, there's a lot of friction in that.
Yeah, well, QR is definitely a light form of augmented reality. I mean, people have been using that in posters. We did a game in January at the ELI conference where we did an alternate reality game across the conference, which seemed to have terrified a lot of people, but it was fun. But one of the things we did is we had clues and information hidden in QR codes that were on posters or on handouts or even in a conference guide. Microsoft has been working on an alternative to QR, of course. That's worth seeing. Let me walk you back, Dan. I think what
please
I've been
do.
Seeing,
you're here for our education.
Well, you're
as
a serious.
As I said, we're inviting people smarter than us on the podcast to straighten us out. Yes, go
you'll
ahead.
Have to make do with me. Then one of the there seems to be about three levels of this going on when it comes to mobile devices right now. One is that clickers are simply widespread. They're widely used. A big factor in their adoption is when faculty use them at a faculty meeting, then they get it. Clickers are low cost. They're not sexy. They don't get a lot of buzz, but I see them almost everywhere. There's already a peer-reviewed scholarly book on them. That's a big success. It just happened. Now, iPhone and Touch are really getting a lot of buzz. I'm seeing a lot more activity around those in campuses than I am around Android. I don't know if it's because they get so much, you know, the Steve Jobs reality distortion field is so large. I don't know if it's because there's a traditional bond between Apple and educators, but there's a huge splash for that. So we might be seeing, we're talking about this in the chat right now, we might be seeing a replay of the 90s where you've got Windows versus Apple OS, and Apple takes a lead but then loses it to the more open multi-hardware device competitor. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I think handheld hardware is much more challenging to get across right now, but that's one possible avenue. But for right now, Apple has the attention in education.
Yeah, I wrote a blog post just to that effect, comparing the iPhone to the Mac of the 80s and 90s and comparing Android and Android devices to the PC / Microsoft environment of the 90s. And so I do think that is going to play out. I think Apple just got a real jump on the market, and I think we're maybe seeing I think in a couple of years we may be looking back at the iPhone as sort of the prototype or the proof of concept for a whole host of devices that are touchscreen devices, that are mobile devices, and we'll look back on the iPhone as like they showed the way, but now there's a whole ecosystem of other kinds of devices running something like Android, an operating system that's more open.
So more personally, like TiVo. It's the TiVo of the smartphone set.
Yeah, well, TiVo died.
Right.
Right, TiVo's dying. I love TiVo, but I think, you know, let's just hope that the what killed TiVo was the cable companies putting out their own DVRs. Let's hope that with this Verizon doesn't so destroy Android that it becomes its a separate operating environment.
I guess the other big story from this week was some advances in real-time search, except for Mills, who is a obstinate holdout. We're all on Twitter, so we're all contributing to a real-time stream of information, mostly about serious scholarly topics, right? And
absolutely.
of course they are.
And now, has anyone tried bing.com/Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it looks like Bing, the two big remaining search engines, I guess, if that's what they are, Bing and Google are now ingesting all of this real-time stuff using it for a new kind of search. Brian, can you get us up to speed a little bit on what this means and how they separate the junk from the important stuff in these searches and what it might mean in general for finding relevant information in the kind of sea of information that's out there on the web?
Sure. Well, a lot of this goes immediately back to the crash landing in the Hudson River earlier this year of that airplane, where Twitter scooped a bunch of news agencies. And that shocked a lot of people into awareness. It became, I think, like the polar bear in the ice floe, it became the nice photographic locus for that kind of discussion. And a whole bunch of interest peaked on social, on real-time search. How can you get at that kind of stream of fast data? Then we started seeing cases of that. How do you search the discussion on Iran, that kind of thing? So we rapidly had Twitter move the search box or set up a search box on the Twitter.com default interface where it wasn't before. You had the continued growth of hashtags. A lot of small companies have been bustling in on this field trying to figure out ways of doing that. But this week at the Web 2.0 conference, there were a couple of big announcements. Both Google and Microsoft launched, well, you can call it real-time search operations. Very quickly, what happened was Google announced that it would be including Twitter updates as part of regular search. It's not clear when that'll happen. I suspect before January. They also announced something called social search, which may be related to this. That's coming out from Google Labs. I can read to you from a description of it if you want. But the parallel to this is that Microsoft announced Twitter search through Bing. So you can just go to bing.com/Twitter and you can do what you can do with Twitter search, except that it looks a lot nicer. It's got the graphic interface. It's got a big tag cloud floating right there ahead. And a killer, they actually got a leg up over Google in that you can also look at Facebook public status updates through Bing. Google doesn't have an announcement like that to share. So right now, there's a big duel, and it's kind of interesting to see Microsoft pull ahead of Google.
But for the serious market, what are we to make of? I mean, there's a couple of us on the podcast who have actually left Facebook. Is it? I mean, at least for the market,
including me, yeah. Now too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's three of us. Isn't that a lot of, you know, like the keg party I was at last night sort of status updates versus Twitter? There seems to be a lot more sharing of links and professional conversation, at least for the audience of this podcast. Am I wrong about that, or am I missing something, Brian? I probably am. Since I've left, yes.
Well, I haven't seen just to be clear, I'm on both, but I don't do anything directly on Facebook. I pump my Twitter updates to Facebook, and then if anybody responds only on Facebook, then I comment there in kind of secondary way. I haven't seen a good content analysis in the past 6 months about this. I do know that when we did a survey of people at liberal arts colleges about a year ago on how they were using different social media platforms, their use of Facebook was a continuum from the very personal to the very professional. It seems to be kind of all over the map. Personally, anecdotally, I tend to get a bit more personal feedback on Facebook. We had a family health issue, and I got a lot more and terrific responses on Facebook than I did on Twitter. But I did get some on Twitter. So why you would use this? I think you can use the analogy of a newspaper in the classroom. You know, when do you do that? You do it when you're in political science class and you're doing a live topic. You do it in any topic that has some kind of news item. You know, if you're teaching Latin and, you know, some British politician uses a Latin phrase, you bring that in and hand it around and say, look at this. But I think it would have to be classes for which the curriculum is extremely time sensitive. And then we have to do better filtering. The filtering isn't really there right now. If you search for Iran, you know, you'll get just way too much. So I do think this is very early days for real-time search.
Right. If you go to bing.com/Twitter, you now get hot topics on Twitter, which seems a lot like that sort of trending topics list. Gosh, I can't believe this. A week after the event, it's still trending Balloon Boy. although added to that is Cassette Boy. What is Cassette Boy? I don't even know what that is. I think the interesting piece is below that. There's a set of the most tweeted links, which actually does get a little bit better at, I mean, rather than these keyword searches, a little bit better at sort of what's going on. So, you know,
I got to say, listening to what you just said, Dan, I really am starting to feel left out here.
You could be Balloon Boy.
I want to say about the live search stuff that it brings tears to my eyes because it is, I mean, the whole issue of doing search information retrieval problems is basically to say, okay, well, we have this massive pile of information, And the way it is organized does not facilitate finding things quickly. So you take that pile, move it someplace else, radically reorganize it, and that is what allows you to search things so quickly. Mm. Trying to do that in real time or with very small time delays sounds to me like such a devastatingly difficult technical problem. It's just interesting to watch. I'm dying to see like how they're even pulling this off on the kind of scale that you would need for Twitter. I mean, it's a really tricky
right.
thing.
It's hundreds of millions of tweets a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, like, I can't even sort of wrap my mind around the kind of algorithm. I mean, is it just a, I mean, I know looking, reading in the technical literature about Twitter, there's some sense in which Twitter is just absolutely the dumbest program ever written. I mean, there's nothing sophisticated about it except the scale. The scale is so immense that it had to have very sophisticated threading models. It's been rewritten a couple of times and, you know, all this sort of thing. And the search issue sounds like that. It's a very difficult problem, and it will be interesting to see who gets there first. And it might not be the usual players.
Well,
in the end, it might be the usual players who
sure.
But it might, you know, it is not the same game as other things in the information retrieval space. So,
but it is interesting to think about, though, that, you know, you, back in the day when there was the thought of Google dueling with Yahoo, back before Yahoo really decided to energetically race around the drain, I mean, there was this argument that Google was better at algorithmic work and Yahoo mm-hmm. was better at social work.
Mm-hmm.
And Microsoft has never managed to get a handle on the social, much like Apple. And, you know, so if it's Microsoft versus Google dueling, these aren't companies that are traditionally having strengths in that. But if I can, oh gosh, Dan, I don't know if this is a bridge to another subject or not. In the
Please,
Horizon Report.
Do a better job at segueing than I normally do. Yes.
One of the topics in the Horizon Report is the growth of big data analysis and how there's.
Brian,
you know,
do tell us about this Horizon Port thing. What is this? I've been waiting to hear.
I could do that. If it's,
can,
if it's
can we pause for a second? So the Horizon Report, which actually I'm participating in this year, how would you describe it? It's a let our audience know what it is and
sure.
And what's going on right now with it as you formulate the final report itself.
The Horizon Report is an annual publication published by the New Media Consortium, and it's a form of environmental scanning, trying to look at emerging technologies as they impact education and also creative expression. It's been going on for some years, and the process is very interesting. I should say, at a meta note, it was kind of fun. This summer, I published a paper with the EDUCAUSE Review about methods that campuses could use to understand emerging technologies, talking about various futurism methods. One of the examples I gave was the Horizon Report. An example was called the Delphi process, which I'll explain in a second. And then a couple months later, they picked me to be the head of the board for it. So with that caveat, the Delphi process is an expert analysis process where you take a bunch of experts in a field, ask them questions not too dissimilar to focus group methods, and then ask them to come up with a list of points, a list of concrete items, and then you help them winnow that list down, hopefully trying to maintain a breadth and diversity of expertise and perspective. And that's what this does. There's a group of about 40-odd folks from around the world. Online, they use various technologies like a wiki and Delicious for bookmarking to come up with a list of emerging technologies. That's all on the wiki, which the link to which is probably going to be in the show notes.
Yeah, I think it was actually a pick of a week last week. Lisa mm-hmm. Spiro actually mentioned it as well. I think she's a participant.
Thank you, Lisa. And it's very exciting to see as a process. One of the ways this unfolds is we break it down to a few different stratification systems. One of the series of strata is time, what we think is unfolding in the next year, what we think is unfolding in a horizon of 2 to 3 years, what we see unfolding in 4 to 5 years. We also break it down by various sources. So, for example, if you go through the wiki, you'll see one of the sources of technologies is non-academic, what we see coming from outside of academia. So I think of this as not technologies are coming down the road, but the technologies that are busily at work next door. we also break this down in terms of not technologies, but overall challenges, which can be policy, it can be mentality in the historical sense. They can be political or cultural. So right now we're in midstream. This podcast comes when we've generated a whole bunch of topics, and the NMC staff is busy working these up so that we can process them further. The report is due to come out in January 2010. The EDUCAUSE ELI conference is where it should be announced. ELI helped pay for publication of it. But that's a quick digest. Sorry to go on so long.
No, that's great. So, and what would you say is something that surprised you this year, or some trends that kind of weren't around last year that you think our audience would be interested in?
Well,
what are the up and coming with a bullet, so to speak, on the Billboard charts?
I like the sound of that. There's a kind of sinister level to it. There's a few things that are striking, if we can continue our violent language. One is augmented reality, something I've been pursuing for about a decade, and it's nice to see it beginning to come up. So we're already seeing some talk about various levels of augmented reality. At the very light level, an increase in location-based services up to visualization. So that's something that people are seeing as very revolutionary. Did this podcast talk about Bruce Sterling's address to the LAR company yet?
No, but LAR is one of these software producers of augmented reality, where they have applications actually for Android and I think coming for the iPhone. I think it was just released. Oh, was it just released? Okay, so yeah. This is just get this out on the table for our audience who might not have heard about LAR, but they've got something where you kind of hold your phone up and it actually uses the camera on the phone to show you what's in front of you, but then it overlays on top of that information about your location that can figure out the tilt of your phone, and it uses the GPS of your phone to embed materials. And so, of course, as historians, for instance, we think about the walking tour or something like that.
If you haven't seen this yet,
it's unbelievable.
This is one of those technologies that had our ancestors, if we could go back in time and show it to our ancestors, they would have burned us at the stake.
I mean, it's really pretty incredible.
The first time you see it, it's very, very impressive and striking and weird. Really just marvelous.
It is. And the implications of it are so vast. And in America, I mean, we're, I think, slower than almost every other culture on Earth to come to terms with mobile devices. I don't think we're even ready to think about the privacy implications, the copyright implications. I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a scientist from DARPA. It's a hilarious guy. He introduced himself to me by saying, "Hi, I'm from DARPA. I know more about you than you think we do," which is entertaining. But
so
we're talking about augmented reality, and I said, "Well, so you could imagine one use being creating augmented reality, a layer around Baghdad, so that visitors could walk around and see historical locations. This is where Saddam Hussein did this." He said, "Yes." I said, "Ah, now what if the insurgents?" A couple years ago, right? What if the insurgents then had their own lair? Who gets to control that? He got very excited, and I feel somewhat responsible now. But, I mean, the layers of this are huge. The reason I mentioned LAR, that's LAYAR, is because the science fiction writer and futurist Bruce Sterling gave a talk there where he tried to outline what he saw as the near future of augmented reality, and it's a very smart, very funny talk based on the recent history of technologies that I really recommend. Augmented reality is one very, very large one. We're also talking about new interfaces. And the spur for that is either the insight you get when you first play with a Wii or you first use your iPhone, or when you think about that Gartner observation. You guys probably saw this about a year ago when a Gartner analyst said that the long-term view shows the keyboard and mouse becoming a minority interface, that it would be outnumbered by other interfaces. So if you try to think that through, we were exploring a whole bunch of different interfaces, ranging from the Wii to whatever is going to come from Microsoft under the header now of Project Natal, to the various tablet interfaces we're hearing about and seeing. As a I mean, I always think of the theremin. Nobody thinks of the theremin, but that's one where you have this, you know, wave your hand around and get that. Minority Report was not that great a film, but the design of that has really influenced people. So we're looking at all kinds of non-text-based interfaces. Voice is part of that, where speech recognition just keeps getting better and better, and we have voice search built into the Microsoft mobile operating system as well as the iPhone Google search. So that's a second major topic.
Your example of the theremin, though, is very instructive, because the first time you see a theremin, it seems like such a sort of amazing reimagining of how to interact with a musical instrument. But really, we'd all have a much better chance of carrying off a cello concerto together than making any coherent sound come out of a theremin. It's an almost impossible instrument to play. I mean, there are only a few people on Earth who've ever been able to really play it. And I think this happens a lot with these new, you know, the keyboard and the mouse
sure.
are going to be replaced. But, you know, one sort of historical note to say is that most of the ones that come along will fail. You know, most of the new haptic interface or whatever they are, you know, it will be amazing to watch how few of them actually succeed.
Well, we've already seen cases for this, and I'll resist telling you that I was trained as a cellist, so I could play a cello.
Oh, well,
I spoke
too soon, but I think even even if you are a professional trained cellist, you'd find the theremin almost.
Have you seen the theremin? Did you see the theremin documentary from about a decade ago? That's wonderful. Anyway, the reason I think you're quite right to mention this, and we do have already an ash heap of failed interface projects like this. Think about the iToy, which was a really neat interface, just never caught on. Or you could think about the first version of the tablet PC interface, almost a decade old.
I think virtual reality in general has really not lived up to it. It persists as a dream of computing, and yet it never, you know, it makes great amusement rides, but it never, I don't want to say never, but it.
You know, it's interesting you raise that, Steve, because, you know, so I'm participating in this Horizon Report committee of sort of thinking these new things. And this is the first year that I've participated in the Horizon Report where I've thought, boy, there hasn't been that much talk about virtual reality or Second Life. And longtime listeners of the podcast know that a bunch of us are Second Life skeptics. But it really caught me off guard how little there was about that this year. There was a lot more about interest in mobile, interest in augmented reality, and interest in some of the things we've discussed today, like ebooks and status updates, real-time search. These sorts of social media that I guess feel like they're more, useful, I guess, to people in the academy or at museums and libraries.
I think one of the most striking things about the history of interfaces and the history of innovation in interfaces is that, you know, when we start thinking about that, when people start thinking about that, they are strongly pulled toward or biased in favor of what they already know.
Sure.
And I think virtual reality is actually the most vivid example of this. The historical example I tell my students every year is that, you know, the very first text to roll off Gutenberg's press, if we look at those, you know, really the most striking thing about them is that he is very obviously trying to emulate the handwriting of Rhenish scribes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, block lettering comes later as a technological solution to the problem. You know, he starts, well, this is what text looks like. How else would it look? What else could we roll off the printer?
Right.
And it takes a while for him to realize. And you know, the same, I think that we see that over and over and over in the history of technology. And virtual reality still feels to us like a bold new thing. But fundamentally, isn't it of the character of, you know, we're thinking about an interface in terms of what we already know? You know, it's always struck me as actually a remarkably conservative vision of the computational future to say that, computational interfaces of the future will be just like the interface of the actual phenomenal world. Seems to me, ironically, again, a very kind of maybe an unimaginative view of the future, and I think that's been borne out by the fact that there have been very few really successful virtual reality interfaces.
I think that's a tremendously powerful view. I think that's a very, very good explanatory model for a lot of these changes. I would add to it a smaller model, which is the pop culture influence that for a long time people wanted to replicate the holodeck from Star Trek Next Generation.
Now, which, that was amen. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, except it was a source, but it's interesting. It was a source of so many bad plots. It was one of the weakest devices on that show, and as a result, we haven't. It's interesting that we haven't quite followed that up. But I would come back, Dan. Your point is well taken. We haven't seen a lot of discussion about virtual worlds or their ally, gaming.
Right. A lot less than I expect on gaming as well.
Well, I found we've been doing a lot of work with gaming and liberal arts campuses through Knightley, helping connect a lot of faculty as well as staff who are teaching with or supporting gaming and technology. And I one problem that gaming has run into, besides being still early adopter for its educational use, is that is the economy. Gaming doesn't have to cost anything, but it does have the reputation being or looking pricey. And that's a block in this economy in the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. The second thing, I think, though, if you look at virtual worlds is, we're mostly looking at Second Life, and it seems to have gone through the classic Gartner hype cycle. It had tremendous buzz and publicity, but eventually crashed. We didn't, after the, what was the TV police show that had a Second Life episode? CSI or Crime and Punishment, whichever one it is, their population didn't increase at all. In fact, Second Life's population has plateaued for about 2 years now. Mm. It's in the hype cycle's phase of productivity. So I think it's nicely niched there, yeah. And working, and as a result, didn't get a lot of attention. I don't mean to ventriloquize the whole board. I mean, there's a lot of people we haven't really talked this through, but now just to put it in perspective, next week, New Media Consortium is hosting a conference on the future of technology and emerging technologies. It's in Second Life, but it's going to be in a private island, not a public one. So that's already a huge shift in the experience of Second Life.
Well, we have talked about quite a bit, and unfortunately, we probably have to wind it up here. I really appreciate, Brian, you joining us. I'm looking forward to talking more about the Horizon Report and everything that comes out from that. We'll be sure to discuss it when the final edition comes out. But it is, I would refer people to the show notes for our last podcast, podcast number 45, for a link directly to the wiki where you can see the raw guts of the report being made, which I always like. It's really nice for people to pick out particular topics that they're interested in and see what all the panelists are saying about that. Steve, it's also great to have you on it. It looks like we need a music edition of the Digital Campus Podcast. You're a musician as well, aren't you?
I am. I hesitate to call myself knowing that some of your listeners are probably, real musicians. But yeah, I'm very interested in it. Very interested in music software and music coding. This live coding thing.
Now, Tom Mills and I
talk about one of these days. It's just completely mesmerizing. Yeah.
Well, we are going to have you both back on, and hopefully by then we'll have a new theremin-based introduction to Digital Campus. What do you think, Tom and Mills?
Yeah, I'll learn it in the meantime.
Tom Mills, always great talking to you as well, and we'll talk to you all again in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.
Thank you.